Welcome to Modern Church History. I'm Teresa Holman, and I'm here with Father Michael Witt. Welcome, Father.
Thank you, Teresa. Good to be back.
It's good to have you here, and ready for show number 28.
Well, moving right along.
An interesting topic we have today.
Well, we do. We're going to be talking about Jansenism, that's a little bit of a switch of what we've been doing the last couple sessions.
Right.
We've been kind of heavy into this philosophy and
the natural
astrophysics,
religion,
natural religion, that kind of thing. So it's kind of good to get back at back in home, even if it is dealing with some heresies.
Okay.
I guess I would probably call this Jansenism, holier than thou. it's a very interesting story, and it has to do with a man, a churchman, a man who gave his entire life to the church. He lived a good life. He studied hard. He speculated. His speculative theology was done honestly. And he wrote, without publishing, but he wrote in error. And only after his death was his works discovered, and then with that, the heresy named after him came about.
Mm-hmm.
So, and his name is Cornelius Jansen. He's born in the Netherlands, in Holland.
Okay.
1585. So he's contemporary with a lot of the people that we've been talking about the last couple weeks. Died in 1638.
Okay.
Yeah. He himself studied at the University of Utrecht, and then later on after that, the University of Louvain, which is still one of the great theological centers in the world. Eventually, in fact, at the age of 32, after he was ordained a priest, he became the president of one of the colleges at Louvain. It's the College of Saint-Pulchéry. And there he earned a Ph.D. in theology. And taught exegesis with the rector in 1535. 1536 was named the Bishop of Ypres.
Wow!
So he's certainly a relatively young man, to receive all of these honors. He had an interest, both a personal interest and a professional interest, in the theology of St. Augustine.
Okay.
And read deeply into, especially the doctrine on grace, what St. Augustine says about grace, and wrote a tract, which he did not publish, simply entitled Augustinus. Some of his students and admirers after his death found the tract and published it. And it became quite a bestseller right from the very beginning. Very popular in certain circles of Catholics, especially Catholic laymen, as well as a number of Catholic priests, clergy, around Europe. 3 years later, it was condemned by the Vatican.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some good reasons for it. As you look over the teachings that that Bishop Jansen has in his little tract, one of the things he did was he argued that that human nature is radically corrupted by original sin.
Wow.
Radically corrupted. Uh-huh. Remember that argument that we'd heard about before, with Luther, Calvin on the one side, and then eventually the Council of Trent, arguing that original sin deprived humanity, but did not deprave it, that humanity is not depraved. Without using those terms, Jansen was pretty much saying that there was no hope for human nature. And so there, obviously, he differs with what the Council of Trent was telling us. Secondly, he also argues that man cannot resist concupiscence, that it dominates over grace.
Oh, my. Okay.
And thirdly, then along with that, that the suffering and death of Jesus Christ was only for those who are predestined to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
That he did not come to save, or he did not suffer for all mankind, but only for those who are predestined to be saved. So here we're getting a little bit of that predestination thing again. Along with that, then, he also argued that the sacraments were extremely important. Well, that's nice.
Yeah.
But that in order to receive them, that you had to go through a very, very severe preparation for those sacraments.
Okay.
That, in fact, becomes something of a mode or a custom within the church, certainly all the way to the Second Vatican Council. I don't know, you're too young to remember, but I remember water fountains at our school that had veils, palls over them, because to remind us as we were going to Mass, as we did each day, that we could not even receive water before communion from midnight on. And so, it was quite restricted, quite severe. And then even then, despite everything that Pope Pius X had tried to do in the 20th century, early 20th century, and the Jesuits and many others in convincing people to go to communion regularly. I remember in grade school that at communion time, if you went up to receive communion, people kind of looked at you, certainly the sisters looked at you, and like, well, who do you think you are going to communion? And now that, of course, has just totally changed, but that kind of influence that Jansen had permeated throughout much of the church in preparation for sacraments.
Wow.
It's one thing to take them seriously. It's another thing to take them severely.
Right. Yeah.
And then finally, the last thing that he was that he also mentions, especially dealing with the with communion, that he saw communion as a reward, not as a remedy.
Okay.
So that only after you have achieved a perfect life, then you could receive communion. That's quite different from most of us that come to communion fully recognizing that we're not worthy to do what we're about to do. I mean, that's why the whole penitential rite takes place at the beginning of Mass. After the penitential rite, we have this on Sundays and great feast days, we have a great gloria that follows afterwards, rejoicing in the fact that even though we're not worthy, we're still, God is still calling us to the table.
Right.
And but he denies all of that.
Wow. Know? Okay.
Now, the interesting thing that we have to remember in all of this is that Jansen is really not a heretic. He's never been condemned as a heretic, and rightly so, because in the manuscript itself, although it was never published, at the beginning of the manuscript he had a disclaimer, and he said that if there's any error in which he is, as he writes this, if he writes any error in this manuscript, he right then and there disclaims any ownership and any error. So, you know, remembering the nature of a heretic is someone who has not only spoken the error, but has been corrected and then refuses to accept the correction of the church.
Right.
Says, well, I know more than the church does, and then you go from there. So really, it would not be right to call Bishop Jansen a heretic, because he died a loyal son of the church, thinking incorrectly in some areas, but that's not that terribly hard to do. I remember one of my professors at the seminary said that whenever he went out into parishes and incognito and heard priests preach, he said often he cringed at the heresies that were being taught. You know, sometimes we're not as careful with our wording as we should be. And so Jansen is just one example of somebody who wrote something not intending to publish it, gets published afterwards, and you go off from there. Well, unfortunately, his followers were not quite as magnanimous and obedient as he was. The book itself, Augustinus, was condemned in 1653 by Pope Innocent X in a letter entitled Cum Occasione. It was immediately, the papal letter was immediately rejected by the followers of Jansen. And Jansenism, the ideas of Jansen, had spread quickly enough, and especially in France, to some very powerful people who were looking for some kind of vehicle for Catholic Reformation.
Okay.
And what they saw in this was a Catholic answer to Calvinism, I guess. Sort of Calvinism light, in a sense.
Okay.
And one of those was a very respected priest, the abbot of St. Cyran Monastery in France. His name was Antoine Arnauld. And not only being the abbot of this monastery, he was also the spiritual director for the sisters at Port Royal, which is a very important. There were two Port Royals in Paris, but especially the one in the countryside or in the suburbs, the Port Royal de Champs was a very important center, monastery for this group of sisters who were very austere in their life, and people looked to them. They were holy women, not only holy, but they were also very bright. Many of them came from very exclusive families, and so they were they had no problem with money and influence. And they also had a school that was really avant-garde for its day.
Okay.
It's one of the very few schools that actually taught the children in French rather than in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to see
mm-hmm.
this later on. This will be popularized by the Christian Brothers with Jean-Baptiste de La Salle a little bit later on. But we find that at least in this exclusive school, this being done, the abbot, the abbess of Port Royal convent is a very dynamic and stalwart nun by the name of Mère Angélique.
Okay.
Yeah, which it's funny enough to listeners to EWTN, Mère Angélique translates as Mother Angelica,
okay.
but a different woman entirely. And along with her is allied Blaise Pascal.
Ah, okay.
So these are three very, very powerful personalities to be dealt with, and they're very much taken up with the ideas of Jansenism, and they're using this the theology of Bishop Jansen as an undergirding for a devout life.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the bishop of Paris always had problems with Mère Angélique and with her sisters, and he used to. And then, of course, people would always say, "But they're so holy." And his response, by one of the quotable quotes of the history of this time, was that he said that they're as pure as angels and as disobedient as devils. They locked horns, as uh-huh. Pascal had done, with the Jesuits.
Okay.
And a lot of it had to do with the theology of a Spanish Jesuit. His name is Luis Molina. And what they considered to be a very lax approach, especially to the sacrament of penance. There was let me say something about what Molina was teaching, and Molina's teachings is right down the line of what we find in the Council of Trent. He also deals with this idea of being depraved as opposed to being deprived, and argues that man is deprived through original sin of the supernatural gifts which he had at creation. So the supernatural gifts are now gone, but the natural gifts to resist evil are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And in this way, he's able to argue the moral lives of many pagans. There are certainly many non-believers who live very good moral lives. How is that possible?
Right.
And his answer is, through the natural gifts, we still have those. It's a lot easier to live a good moral life if you have the grace of God in that special grace-filled relationship with God, but that even then God gives natural man the ability to lead a good moral life if they develop those natural gifts.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Molina's position on that, arguing that original sin does not deprave man, but rather deprives him. Now, that's the argument we heard at Trent, and it's the argument we've heard ever since Luther and some of the others had been arguing from the opposite point of view. And therefore, there is hope for repentance and mm-hmm. hope for redemption. Now, what happens is that as this is then applied in the confessional, what you end up with is a lax practice of confession. People went to confession, but the other side of it was the confessors were rather glib about it. Very easy penances, quick acceptance of the sinfulness of the person, and well, just don't do it again. And then they come back next week, well, just don't do it again. Well, just don't do it again. That sort of thing. And there wasn't a real a real challenge mm-hmm. that the confessor really has the obligation to do, to step up to the plate, listen carefully to the person's confession, and then help to lead them, as a spiritual director would, out of this morass of sinfulness,
mm-hmm.
at least with some good suggestions,
right.
some solid penances and things like that. And this is part of the critique that the Port Royal sisters and people like Father Arnault and Blaise Pascal had against the Jesuits, was that they thought that they were kind of doing confession light.
Mm-hmm.
And so, mm-hmm. Nonetheless, you can see that theologically, although they might be doing confession light, they made a lot more sense from a Catholic point of view.
Right.
And so this is where they find themselves locking horns with the Jansenists. They're arguing that man is utterly depraved. Okay, and that the only thing that can save the human being, a single human being, is God's grace redeeming him, and it's only given to those who are predestined, and
okay.
See, then we get into that whole thing again with mm-hmm. that. Now, there's no doubt that solid traditional Catholic theology has always argued that it's God's grace that first begins the dialogue between the human, the person, and God. At one time, theologians used to refer to that as prevenient grace.
Mm-hmm.
There's another term that's used in the Catechism of the Catholic Church today that describes that. But we all understand that it's the initial offer that God makes. We don't go to God and say, okay, we want in.
I'm ready now.
I'm ready now, yeah. It's God who makes the offer. It's right. We who say, no, thanks, come back later, or I gave it the office, or come in, and then you begin that relationship. So that's understood. But their argument is going to be that God's grace is so overwhelming that we don't have the opportunity to say no. And as a result of that, everyone who is going to be saved is going to be saved because those are the ones that God chose to give his overwhelming grace to.
Okay.
You got some real problems
right.
with all of that.
Right.
So, and part of the problem you have with all of that is that you end up with a hell full of innocent souls
mm-hmm.
who just are there because God decided that he didn't want to save them. And you kind of ask the question,
why would he be created them if that's why he...
Yeah.
Right.
And then of course, then, I don't know what the Jansenist answer necessarily is, but the Calvinist answer was, don't ask questions like that. a doctrine like this, those kind of ideas encouraged great piety on the part of the people who thought that they were among the saved.
Mm-hmm.
And this was very encouraging mm-hmm. for Catholics who perhaps had been living a rather lax life. Like, for instance, the King of France at the time, Louis XIV, wasn't exactly the model of virtue.
Mm-hmm.
And wasn't exactly standing in the line of Louis
IX
by
right.
any means. And so they would look at somebody like him, or you could name any number of others who were not particularly religious. And yet they had all the trappings of being Catholic, and so they seem to be rather hypocritical. Now then you have these sisters at Port Royal who are really living what they believe, and it's quite attractive. It's quite beautiful. So it's very appealing to certain elements in the Catholic community, particularly the bourgeoisie, that's to say the city dwellers, not the poor city dwellers, but we're talking about the wealthy,
mm-hmm.
And so they're attracted to that lifestyle, and they give generously, and they try to live their lives similarly. Also, along with that, are a number of priests, canons, important. Priests in France who also try to live holy and devout lives and rather stringent lives. And then a number of intellectuals. It seems as though among the Augustinian community there was more of an attraction also than some of the others. I don't know, maybe it was a reaction against the Jesuits or something. And then you also have a number of nobles in the nobility, in fact, even right into the royal family, who also changed their lives, just totally changed their lives and began living very austere Christian lives where they had been living licentious lives. They're now going to be living austere lives. And so it really was quite impressive.
Right.
One historian noted the following, because in this movement, more and more Protestants began to take, Huguenots began to take note of this. And W.H. Lewis said the following. He said, "In the Jansenist quarrel, Protestant sympathies were engaged. Protestants, however erroneously, saw Jansenism as a crypto-Protestant movement within the Roman Catholic Church, which might ultimately lead to a reunion of Christendom on Protestant terms."
Okay.
They were wrong on that one.
Yes.
But you can see where they were coming from.
Yes, you can.
Here you have a group of people who are living very puritanical lives, so they're like Catholic Puritans. There's the bridge between Calvinist Puritans and Catholic Puritans coming together, and they might find the way to bring about the rapprochement based upon Calvinist theology, which is that rather austere interpretation of St. Augustine. Yeah. Well, instead, what happens is the history makes quite an interesting turn. Two forces that had been opposed to each other throughout the first half of the reign of Louis XIV all of a sudden reconciled.
Okay.
And the two forces are, first of all, the Vatican, which we've seen already has taken a theological stand against Jansenism, and now it finds itself with an ally it had not even hoped would ever come to its side, and that is Versailles, the royal palace of Louis XIV. Louis makes a pretty strong religious conversion himself midway through his life. He had been quite a carouser. I mean, he had a couple of girlfriends on the side and lots of activities going on, and nobody, you know, questioned that. That was just the way things were. Somehow in the middle of his life, he had some kind of a change of heart, and he saw Jansenism as being a danger, but he's, you know, he hasn't totally changed. Not only a danger to the church, which he would be somewhat concerned about, but especially a danger to himself and his throne. Yeah, we're dealing with disobedient people here. These are people who are independent. One of the things that's so interesting that I found to be so fascinating about Louis XIV that gives us real insight into this man has to do with the chapel that he built at Versailles. Versailles is a huge palace. It's actually multiple buildings sort of linked together in an enormous park. And then beyond that, there was another building, huge mansion built called the Grand Trianon. And beyond that, there was another one to get away from all the crowds that was called the Petit Trianon, which is a huge place in itself. So he had, I mean, he could accommodate 10,000 guests at Versailles.
Oh, 10,000.
You know, that's enormous.
That is enormous.
Yeah, and feed them and the whole works. I mean, it was just, he ran the government basically from Versailles. And so one of the interesting, I found, I had an opportunity to spend a day there, and I found one of the most interesting things about it was its chapel. The chapel was in the process of being renovated when I was there some years back, but the chapel itself, you could go into it and see. And what was so fascinating was that all the pews were facing backwards. You can imagine. So you've got the priest at the altar in the sanctuary, as was the custom of the day, the altar at the wall, so the priest is facing his back to the congregation,
right.
Except if you could imagine, the congregation then had its back facing the priest's back, so they were looking away from the priest looking away.
Why was that?
Well, that was the most fascinating part. At the far end of the back of the chapel was a single prie-dieu, okay, single kneeler.
Uh-huh.
That was the royal prelude. The king knelt there. In other words, the priest is saying Mass. The king is the only one observing Mass being said, and everyone else enters into the Mass through the king.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, isn't that something? I have never seen anything like that before. Louis XIV is the one who did this. Yes. Yes.
Oh, gosh. So, I could see his ancestors rocking, reeling.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he takes religion very seriously, especially since he's the one who's doling it out.
Yeah.
You know? And so when he looks at some of the aristocracy, even within his own royal family, one of the greatest supporters of the sisters was none other than his sister, Anne of Bourbon.
Okay.
And she was a powerful force to be dealt with. And so he looked upon these Jansenists as being very dangerous. Yeah, mm-hmm. They might be very holy and they might be very pious, but they're also very dangerous. And so it was happy news for him to hear that they were also heretical.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so that's why you have that link up between the two groups, between the Vatican and the and Louis XIV,
Versailles.
What then happens is that with the death of Anne of Bourbon, Louis now begins moving step by step to try to contain this force. And in July of 1700, the center for Jansenism, and by the way, Pascal eventually will float away from this, pretty much return to the fold, but the center of Jansenism is this monastery called Port Royal Les Champs,
okay,
out in the fields, and it was put under the authority. The king announced that it would become subservient to the other Port Royal. That's the Port Royal de Paris, the monastery that was in the city. That monastery was loyal to the church and orthodox. And so the abbess of that monastery was now given authority over the other monastery.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Difficult to deal with, though. Now, this is in July. And because of the resistance of the nuns out in the Port Royal de Champs, eventually, then, in October of that year, 1700, the provost of Paris, basically the combination of mayor, non-elected, mayor, prefect, prefect of police, whatever, gathered together a troop of archers and went out to the monastery and literally closed it up, broke up the monastery.
Wow. Okay.
Took all the nuns who were there. He had carts with him. And he carted these nuns to monasteries all throughout France.
Wow.
They were just sent out to monasteries all throughout France and put into monasteries that were known for being anti-Jansenist.
Okay.
And that's how they diffused the threat of this particular monastery. In 1710... this thing continued haunting Louis so much that now a relatively old man, he's been on the throne for many, many years, but in 1710 he had construction workers go out to this abandoned monastery and take it apart, literally.
Wow.
Taking it stone by stone apart so that no stone stood upon a stone in this monastery so he wouldn't have to deal with it. 1 year later he was still concerned about this. I don't know if he was having nightmares or what, but he had diggers go out and they dug up the graves of the nuns in that field.
Oh my goodness.
In the field behind the what had been the monastery, and they were put into another mass grave, and then the fields, by the order of the king, were then planted with crops.
Wow.
That's something. I mean, he was pretty extreme about this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another 2 years after that, then the a papal bull, Unigenitus, formally condemned Jansenism. The other one, Cum Occasione, had condemned Augustinus, the book. But here, Jansenism itself, and it pretty much targets the leader of New Jansenism, once again, another Frenchman. His name is Pasquier Quisnel, and he in this bull, 101 propositions of him are condemned, spot by spot in each of the propositions. Interestingly enough, the Archbishop of Paris, the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris, who himself, now this Archbishop has a certain amount of, well, he's not particularly Jansenist, but at the same time, he has a very, very strong sense of Gallicanism. In other words, the Church of France is independent. The Pope is welcome to send suggestions, you know, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
Well, the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris joined with 16 other French bishops arguing for Gallicanism, for the independence of the French Church, and said the following. This is a quote. It said, "The bulla," okay, this letter, "is not infallible unless a council is called and agrees." Now, haven't we heard that before?
Yes,
I mean,
we
for
have.
Hundreds of years, this kind of stuff has been popping up. So many of these people that, you know, we talked to, Cardinal Dailly, remember, and so many of these others. I'm thinking of William of Ockham and Marcellinus of Padua and all of these people. So anyway, there we are again with this. And here it is now in the 1700s, and the same thing is also said. That particular letter did not impress either the Pope, who was Clement the 11th at the time, who basically said, "My letter stands," or Louis the 14th, who had a certain amount of clout.
Right. Okay.
However, Louis the 14th was not able to act on this, and in 1715 he died.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He's a very interesting man as you look back on his reign. The first half of his reign, he really looks like a French equivalent of Henry VIII. I guess that's not going to take much, and off he's going to go. In the second half, he becomes so sectarian, he's almost an embarrassment. Even to fellow Catholics.
That's, yeah. Wow. That's,
you know,
a big change, isn't it? To go from Henry VIII to...
that's right. There are a lot of courses in modern European history that either end or begin with 1715 as their date, because they look on Louis the 14th as being this great watershed, you know, and then everything changes. But really, when you look at it, nothing changes. Because Louis the 15th takes over, and he's not a heck of a lot different, except he's not quite as clever as Louis the 14th, and he doesn't have the work ethic that Louis the 14th had. Louis the 14th was a workaholic. He loved committee meetings, and he would just put in incredible hours. Nobody following him after that had any intention of doing that. And Louis the 15th comes. Oftentimes, people mistake the Louis the 14th with that quote, "Après moi le déluge," after me the flood. It's not Louis the 14th. It was Louis the 15th who had said that, and probably because he really knew that the flood was about to take place.
Okay.
If he had read the balance sheet of France at the time of his death, he knew, because they were in really deep doo-doo financially. Not so with Louis the 14th, and that was a little bit different.
Okay.
But what's going to happen then is you're going to have a whole generation follow afterwards, continuing on a lot of the same things that were going on at the time of Louis the 14th. We'll look at this as we look at the coming of the French Revolution. There's a new, younger aristocracy, which is also impoverished during the time of Louis the 15th, which is not going to be as obedient and as docile as Louis the 14th's aristocracy.
Okay.
Many of those people just went out to Versailles. They were invited to Versailles. It became a gilded cage for them. They couldn't leave. They didn't want to leave. It was their only access to the king. But it was so demeaning at the same time. They did nothing. They were just like little lap dogs sitting around at the pleasure of the king.
Hmm.
And it was that was his way of controlling the aristocracy.
Uh-huh.
What happens is that, just in a nutshell, is that there were two bubbles that burst financial bubbles in the early 1700s. And one of those, many French aristocrats had invested very heavily in. And when it went under, they lost all their money. And so the next generation following after them, the younger people coming up, had the royal titles, had the education, and didn't have the money to rest on, so they had to be hustlers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the ones who are really going to try to push the government in such a way to give them greater responsibility and power, and they're really the ones who are going to bring about the first phase of the French Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm getting ahead of myself here. To keep that in mind,
right,
is what's coming down the pike. In the end, Jansenism is going to be sort of the landscape of Catholicism for the next couple hundred years. Not the theology. The theology pretty much goes by the wayside.
Okay.
But it's more the lifestyle. That very austere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh, yeah. Okay. Okay.
I guess, there's one other thing that you could say about this era, because we're really on the verge of the Enlightenment, which we were just talking a little bit about, Rousseau and Voltaire and these others. The Catholic Church, and especially Catholic clergy, come in for incredible barbs and satire and hatred. You remember Voltaire's little statement that he hopes to live long enough to see the last king strangled with the entrails of the last priest. That's not just clever. There's something eating on this guy, pretty much. And there's a good reason for that, and that is because there are two world views that are set up that are simply at odds with each other and in competition. And I'd like to end this segment with a little quote from Walter Dorn. He's a secular historian, but he writes a book called The Competition for Empire. And in this, he reflects on the incredible bigotry of the Enlightenment characters against Catholics and against Catholicism. And he said the following. He said, "Orthodox Catholic dogma presented not merely a system of religious metaphysics and a code of ethics, but an elaborate cosmology that was equivalent to a complete interpretation of geology, of ethnography, of world history, and of the origins of mankind."
Wow.
Yeah. That whole sense of what we understand as dignity.
Yeah.
And remember earlier on we had that concept of the dignity of man, one of our current gurus of science argued that the dignity comes at the end of mankind, and
right,
we're arguing that it comes at the creation of mankind. Creation and the incarnation brings about the dignity of mankind. Those are really big differences, and which separates the Catholic community from the secular community of the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, and undoubtedly the 21st century.
Great.
You know? And we'll see some attempts to accommodate that in the future when we look at modernism and 19th century Catholic liberalism. But in the end, the church does not sell out its doctrine, regardless of what seems to be current at the time.
We got somebody up there holding us
accountable.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. One of the unsung elements that's going on during this time period really is the incredible number of saints in the church in the 17th century and the 18th century that we don't pay a lot of attention to because we're running around with all this other stuff of Jansenism and all. And so what I'd really like to zero in on is some of the popular devotions of the time and some of the saints, and then build on that, because this is really a time of the fruition of much of the Catholic Reformation period. And if we were visual as well as audio, we would probably do some stuff on the Baroque, because quite honestly, the whole Baroque movement is a Catholic movement, is a Catholic architectural movement. You don't find any Baroque Lutheran churches, I can't think of any offhand. The Baroque really didn't take England by storm. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty Catholic thing. Spanish, Italian, German, Mexican also. Some of the most incredible cathedrals in Mexico are Baroque. And it's just an expression of great Catholic devotion and optimism. Not only optimism of the future, but optimism of the current relationship, the present contemporary relationship between the church militant mm-hmm. and the church triumphant. Yeah. And I was describing this to my nephew just last night. We were talking about some of the churches he had seen this past summer in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And he was describing some as being Romanesque and some as being Gothic. And then he was talking about some of these others that are clearly... Baroque, and this is mainly in southern Germany. And I said to him, I said, do you remember what the ceilings looked like? And he said, well, yeah, they were painted like the sky. And there were, you know, angels and all kinds of three-dimensional beings all over. And I said, yeah, that's the whole idea behind the Baroque, is that, you know, when you walked into a Romanesque church during the earlier Middle Ages, you felt safe because of the huge walls around you, and you had a community of faith there. The Gothic, you walk into that, and it almost causes you to look upward. Everything, all the spires go upward. There's lots of light, lots of colored light with all of the stained glass windows. The Baroque, you walk in, and it's almost as if you're walking into heaven, and you've got angels all around you and saints all around you, and you're just sort of like there, but you're not there yet, you know?
Uh-huh.
And that's sort of the spirit of the Baroque. So, like I say, I don't have any pictures of it, but we'll have to take it for granted. But there are lots of things going on besides Jansenism within the church. You also have, this is also an age of quietism, and there you have a very pious movement that again heads in such a direction that if you lean a little bit further, you're going to fall off the precipice.
Okay.
You know? This is popularized by a Spanish mystic. His name is Miguel de Molinas. And he is arguing in favor of the total passivity toward God. A total passivity toward God, especially in prayer. This is an emptying of yourself and letting God in.
Hmm.
Now, that's wonderful. It leads to a total detachment,
mm-hmm.
okay, loss of all attachments around. And here's the thing that kind of causes you to pause for a bit. Even the attachment of attaining heaven. I see you frowning
okay.
a bit.
Okay, yeah, I was right. thinking about that one there.
Yeah, I don't know if I would necessarily go along with that myself.
That's what I want to attach to.
I know, but that's, I think that's where the precipice of quietism goes. You know, the reason why you're totally emptying yourself to be filled with God is so that you have this relationship with God, which
right.
is, by definition, your state in heaven.
Right.
You know, so I think there's a tendency to go a bit too far.
Okay.
One of the great writers of the day, Francois Fenelon, said, taking this idea of quietism, taking this idea that we should go into church and be like a statue in church.
Okay. I have a problem with that one too.
Yeah. Now he's saying that he doesn't mean this in a physical church.
Okay.
He means and once again, you can see the positive as well as the negative. What's
yes,
he saying?
Yes, you can.
What he's saying is that find out what statue you are and allow God to place you in the church, or bigger church,
okay.
in the role in which you're
in which
supposed
that
to do.
Person played. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, like for instance, aspiring to to an office of the church. You know, he's arguing against that.
Okay.
If God sends you in such a way that you end up being the Bishop of Juneau, Alaska, then that's your place.
Okay.
And don't hanker to be sent to Vancouver instead or something.
Okay.
You know, you get
okay.
the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you join an order, and then all of a sudden you want to be Mother Superior or something, or even more powerful than that, the econome, so you can determine what everyone eats. But now that's the good side of it. Now the bad side of it is this statue concept.
Right.
Yeah. And then he even argues that includes if God decides to place us in hell. No,
wait a minute.
Yeah, wait a minute. And this, interestingly enough, is the morphing, I guess you could say, of a very legitimate theology or spirituality that is actually grounded in St. Francis de Sales. And these people have taken this and run with it right over the cliff.
Right.
Okay. St. Francis de Sales, in his spirituality, speaks about what he refers to as a liquefaction, which is a flowing into what one loves, to being lost in the moment and moving in and out of that love. It's like sitting before, kneeling before, standing before the Blessed Sacrament. And the liquefaction he's talking about there is allowing yourself to be absorbed by the incredible presence of Christ, that gift of the real presence, and just basking in that.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, the Sacred Heart, those beautiful pictures of the Divine Mercy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, icons. Our Lady of Guadalupe,
Mother Perpetual Help.
Perpetual Help, yeah, right behind you there.
Yeah.
And allow that mystical relationship to take place and be built up. That's what he was talking about.
Right. Okay.
And with St. Francis of Sales, it was very optimistic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He believes that a loving God will catch us in that. You know, like if we fall into his arms, he will catch us.
Right.
And there will be then growing out of that, this great relationship.
Okay, I'm okay there.
Okay. And you can see how people are moving. These people like De Molinas and Fenelon move beyond that.
Mm-hmm.
For one thing, they are living in an age which is not so optimistic as Francis de Sales.
Mm-hmm.
Who was not living in an optimistic age and not living in an optimistic city. He was Bishop of Geneva, of all things. You know, Calvin,
yeah, that was a bad time.
Calvin, City of God. Uh-huh. And yet, his personality was such that he was a great positive influence. These are people who are living at a more pessimistic time. Rationalism has gotten such a force. It dominates philosophy, even schools of theology. And so there's a repulsion away from this abstract theology and abstract philosophy and toward a pious mysticism, which is good. But when taken over the precipice, as in the case of the statue stuff, then it doesn't serve any purpose at all, and any positive purpose. Now, that's not to say that there weren't wonderful and mystical devotions that were going on at the time. This is a time when, throughout the church in general, there is a great devotion to the child Jesus.
Ah, okay.
You know?
Okay. So, the infant of Prague. All right. Is that this time? Or is it? No, it's a different.
It's a slightly different time. And,
okay,
you know, let's hold off on that
one. Okay.
But certainly the Sacred Heart.
Great
devotion to the Sacred Heart. To the Virgin, the Blessed Virgin. It's a great devotion to Mary. Among the people of Europe at the time. This concept of the nuptial relationship with God. We see so often in religious orders, especially in religious orders of women, that taking of vows and the wedding rings and the veil and all of those aspects that speak to that. Certainly in the 20th century, certainly coming out of the Second Vatican Council, we have such a strong understanding of that nuptial relationship between the bride and Christ. You know.
Would this have been about the time that nuns began wearing a ring symbolizing that, or had that been happening before?
You know, I don't know that for a fact. I really don't.
I've always thought it a beautiful concept in the sharing of the nuptial relationship and them wearing that ring. I wondered where it came from. I think back to, wasn't it St. Catherine, wasn't it, that had the...
Of Siena?
Who was the saint that had the ring that couldn't be seen, but it was a...
I don't know that.
I can't remember who that is right now.
What?
It's Catherine, I think. I think it's Catherine of Siena.
Catherine of Siena?
Uh-huh.
Well, I'll take your word for it.
I'll have to check that one out for next week, I guess.
Well, there you go. And so, you know, many of the other things, the veneration of saints is certainly very popular at the time. Corpus Christi processions are popularized at the time. It happened before, but they're very popular in this time. Pilgrimages, the exposition of the Blessed Sacrament. This whole idea of catching a glimpse of heaven while still on earth. You know, and that's that Baroque idea once again.
Yes.
Looking up to the ceiling of the church and seeing clouds and heavenly figures floating amongst those clouds. That's pretty much that idea. There are some real solid foundations taking place also in the same period. For instance, in 1664, we'll take a little look at this later on, the founding of the Trappists.
Oh, okay.
And like I say, we'll talk about this a little bit later. And then also in 1680, the institution of the Brothers of the Christian Schools by Jean-Baptiste de La Salle.
Okay.
We'll be saying a lot of that a little bit later on because of the incredible importance that that order has for Catholic education,
right.
Education in general, the innovations. In 1725, the founding of the Passionists.
Oh, wow.
1732, the Redemptorists. So this is not a time of sleeping.
No.
As far as the church is concerned, there's a lot of stuff going on. One of the most important earlier people in this who is going to have a lot of influence on an institution that will have a lot of influence on a lot of people who have influence, and sometimes that's the way God works, is an oratorian by the name of Jean-Jacques Ollier.
Okay.
He believed that it was important to found a seminary, a really top-flight seminary for the training of priests, for the formation of priests, and this for secular priests, that is to say, for diocesan priests.
Mm-hmm.
Already, after the Council of Trent, mandates had been set up to establish seminaries. We'll talk a little bit about that, but a little later on, we're going to take a good look at Saint-Sulpice, because I think it's well worth looking at. It is a premier seminary of its age, and so we'll take a look at what Jean-Jacques Ollier does in founding that seminary. He himself teaches that the Holy Spirit really slays us, basically reduces us to nothingness, which is nothing more than the religious experience that we have. And only then are we able to begin to build ourselves back again. And by doing that, with the grace of God, cooperating with the grace of God, and in doing that, recognizing the dignity of humanity, which comes through the incarnation. The humanity of Christ,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
and that fits in with the whole spirit of this age, the popular devotions, you know, the Child Jesus of adoration of the Sacred Heart, the popularization of the Rosary once again.
Okay,
these things become so incredibly important, and that's going to be the grounding. What the Holy Father in his letter, Pastoris Tabo Vobis, I Will Give You Shepherds. A number of years ago, Pope John Paul II issued this incredible letter on the formation of new priests in the seminaries. And one of the aspects of that is what he refers to as human formation.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have well-rounded human beings before you can build the spiritual formation. And certainly, Ollier understood that. And makes that part and parcel of what he does at Saint-Sulpice.
Okay. Yeah. Where is that?
It's in Paris.
It's in Paris.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And interestingly enough, it has always been a real bulwark of strong Catholic tradition. And I just add a little editorial note that it's ironic that in this book that's become so popular, it's a fiction. We have to constantly remember it's a fiction called The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people are reading it, and a lot of Catholics are reading it, and unfortunately they're trying to learn their theology and church history from a book that is clearly not. It's in this book, one of the things that just, among many things that just sent me up a wall was the mention of Saint-Sulpice, the seminary, as having a long tradition of producing unorthodox priests. That is the exact opposite of what happened. So anyway, just a little caveat to reading novels and
that
they're in the...
Beware what you read.
That's exactly right, you know. But and so Saint-Sulpice is anything but that.
Yeah, just because it's in print.
Yeah, right. And so, and like I said, as we come back next time around, we'll take a look at some of these incredible saints, people like St. Alphonsus Liguori, Jean-Baptiste de La Salle, John Eudes, Paul of the Cross, the establishment of the Trappists and all. So this is a very rich period of church history.
We've got another good wave of saints coming up.
Yes, we do.
All right.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Father. Can we close with a prayer?
Sure. Glory be to the Father, to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
As it was in the beginning, is now, and ever shall be, a world without end. Amen. Thank you, Father.